The Writers Guild has always been the guild that walks. It's always been the guild that really works and functions within Hollywood as a union. It was the first and most radical union within the ranks of the Hollywood guilds, for sure. In the 20s, when guild activity started to percolate and the kind of sense that unions were something that people needed to form to protect themselves as workers within the system, there was an attempt by the powers that be, Louis B. Mayer, for example, to do an end run. So they started a kind of fake company union-ish kind of thing called the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, AMPAS, which continues to this day to hand out the Oscars. It was actually started as a company union front in an attempt to sideline union activities and create a space where people could join as professionals without all that union stuff, right? So every time you flick on the Oscars, keep that in mind. It really began, those are its origins.
Thank you for joining us for the Woodstock Film Festival Let's Talk Film podcast. I'm your host, Katie Mejia. Today, I am joined by co-host Willis Williams and our special guest, James Seamus. Established in 2000, the Woodstock Film Festival is a not-for-profit organization that nurtures and supports emerging and established filmmakers, sharing their creative voices through an annual festival and year-round programming to promote culture, diversity, community, educational opportunities, and economic growth. This year's film festival is September 27th to October 1st. We actually had double the submissions, so hopefully that means double the film feature films and shorts that will be featured this year. James Seamus is an award-winning screenwriter, The Ice Storm, producer, Brokeback Mountain, and former CEO of Focus Features, Dallas Buyers Club, Lost in Translation. He created, executive produced, and was showrunner on the hit Mexican limited series for Netflix, Somos. Seamus is professor of professional practice in Columbia University's School of the Arts, where he teaches film history and theory. He serves on the negotiating committee of the Writers Guild of America, whose members are currently on strike. Thanks for joining us today, James.
Thank you for having me.
So today, as you might expect, we are going to get into the writer's strike. But to kick things off, before we jump in with our resident SAG member and co-host Willis, you were honored with the Trailblazer Award by Ang Lee at the Woodstock Film Festival. So we just want to, you know, go down memory lane for a second and just tell us what that was like.
I have no memories whatsoever. It was just a blowout weekend. Apparently it all happened though, because I still have the award in my study somewhere at home. I'm Googling it. I think it was 2008. I'm not sure. It feels like that was from a different era. And yet I think, in fact, things are still very much the same in terms of the challenges, in terms of the sense of a need for a continuing tending to the community and the independent media world. I think there's been an expansion of that community that's been salutary, and there's been a fundamental change in the discourses that underlie the notion of that community to really bring forward new voices and other communities that have long been kind of structurally removed from much of the independent landscape along lines that are race, racial, class, gender, and sexuality. So it's really interesting to see the way in which the seeds of all those discourses were nurtured within the independent community, starting well before the 1980s, when narrative independent films really started to take their place in the distribution landscape, and businesses started to really coalesce around them. Those businesses often became subsidiaries of large studios, like the business I ran at Focus, which was a part of the Universal construct. So you see this a really interesting story, or an infinite number of stories flowering that come about when narrative feature filmmaking in particular, although again, that's changing now in terms of our definitions of what makes up this community, starts to interface with communities long silenced by the studio system and the television, you know, audio televisual systems and industries. So it starts really to take off in the 80s, as I said, but really when you look back at people like John Cassavetes in the late 50s, and you look at Shirley Clarke, and you look at a really interesting hybrid space of this kind of work before it became so commercialized, you can see that often what we think of as progress in spaces like those provided by the Woodstock Film Festival are returns back to places where production protocols, financing, but also the politics and sense of community are under constant stress and interaction from the margins. And I think Woodstock continues to play a really vital role in the continued reformation of that discourse in those worlds.
Yeah, and before I hand it off to Willis, it was actually, I believe, 2007, 1 year before you won this award and was honored at the Woodstock Film Festival for your, by the way, Trailblazer Award is like the combination of an artist and a business person. Like you're able to kind of merge those worlds, which I guess in today's age, you definitely need to be able to do that to be successful in general. But to be CEO of Focus Features during that time, I mean, things have changed. But the question is, the last writer's strike was in 2007. And so why did they strike back then?
You know, back in 2007, I should go back a little further for history for folks who are interested in the current Writers Guild strike and the potential Screen Actors Guild strike. You never know. see, Willis is like, we'll get into that later, I'm sure. Really to the early 2000s, and even before that, the Writers Guild has always been the guild that walks. It's always been the guild that really works and functions within Hollywood as a union. Part of that is cultural. It was and historical. It was started in the midst of the Depression by a bunch of communists, to be honest, John Howard Lawson and others. It was the first and most radical union within the ranks of the Hollywood guilds, for sure. In the 20s, when guild activity started to percolate and the kind of sense that unions were something that people needed to form to protect themselves as workers within the system, there was an attempt by the powers that be, Louis B. Mayer, for example, to do an end run. So they started a kind of fake company union-ish kind of thing called the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, AMPAS, which continues to this day to hand out the Oscars. It was actually started as a company union front in an attempt to sideline union activities and create a space where people could join as professionals without all that union stuff, right? So every time you flick on the Oscars, keep that in mind. It really began, those are its origins. Through the 40s, the Writers Guild maintained a fairly robust radical culture. But of course, with the end, in particular, of World War II and the rise of anti-union activity that dovetailed with the Red Scare, in other words, we think of the House Un-American Affairs Activities Committee and Joseph McCarthy, you know, the McCarthy hearings, as having their own specific politics, but actually those politics are rooted in labor busting, the union busting and anti-labor activities. So it was not an accident that Hollywood became the locus for a great deal of the conflicts in the 40s. So you had fake unions again. The studios were really good at that, fighting real unions. Google the battle at Warner Brothers. You'll see a lot of bats and chains and knives as the Chicago mob, which was brought in by the studio heads to run the fake union, did battle with the real union. Of course, the communists who had started the Writers Guild were relentlessly hounded out of the business, even the country, and certainly out of the union by the late 40s and early 50s. And yet... The guild maintained a culture of workers first, and by 1960 went out on strike in a huge strike action, later joined months later, in fact, by Screen Actors Guild. So I think the only time they both went out at the same time, and one of the few times the actors have gone out on strike. The directors always poo-poo often historically these kinds of labor actions, and have only gone out on strike in the last few decades for a couple of minutes. But so that 1960 strike got what we call residuals, that is to say some piece of the revenue pie, so that you could be assured between jobs and even afterwards if your show is a success of some kind or your movie was, that you would get some benefit downstream, just as the companies who are exploiting your labor are getting. And that got patterned to the other guilds, that battle. And then by the 1980s, things were getting pretty stressed again for labor in Hollywood. There was a big strike in 88 that the Guild conducted that was that went on for a long time and that did not end particularly successfully for the Guild at that point. They didn't have the leverage. They didn't have the labor solidarity that we see today. They're really odd on their own. But they got something. And it also established the bona fides for the Guild that, once again, writers would walk and not just talk. Right. So, but in the wake of that, it took a long time for the Guild to recover its own internal culture of workers first. And that culture really decisively got turned around in the early 2000s. So I had the privilege of being on the negotiating committee for the Writers Guild of America back in the early 2000s, as I am now. I did have to step off because in the middle of my service, I sold my company, Good Machine, an independent production and finance and a sales company to Universal, and suddenly became a studio boss running a studio that I formed called Focus Features, as you mentioned. So I thought, probably better to step aside and let it roll. As a result of those, the activity around that negotiation, though, which did not result in a strike, a new wave of very activist members of the Guild, part of a group between the East and the West Coast that came together and really transformed the culture back to a progressive culture, a really forward-thinking culture. And the payoff to that activity was a sweeping out of the old guard that established itself in the wake of the 1988 strike, and a readiness by 2007 to really tackle the studios. What was interesting, going to your question now, I know this is rather not such a short answer, why did they go out? What were the issues? Well, the issue was actually very abstract. And at the time, the entire town, including, again, many of our fellow workers, felt that the writers were making a mistake in going out over what we thought was fundamental, even though it represented a de minimis fraction of our revenues and our earnings at that time. And what we were really primarily walking out on was this thing called the internets, which was called new media, and the studio's insistence that it was nothing, it was just an experiment, and we're going to hire people to write stuff for that thing, but it shouldn't be Guild covered because we're not making any money at it anyhow. So fast forward, as you can see, that little thing called new media now represents the majority of income for our members, and that therefore that strike saved our health and pension and welfare fund. It saved the livelihoods that created really sustainable careers for many years for many of our members, even though coverage within that space is still catching up for many of our writers. It's not what it is for example, network television or even basic or pay cable TV. So we're still fighting on that front. But you can imagine if we hadn't walked and there was no pattern for actors, directors, and other Guild members, there would be no health care for workers in the entertainment industry in the United States. Those plans would have gone bankrupt pretty soon thereafter as the amount and volume of work within the streaming space picked up. So here we are now in 2023. And once again, we seem to be walking on stuff that is both real, that's happening now to writers, that is to say, the incredible shrinking lengths at which, in particular, television writers are employed to create seasons, how they're being fired off of those shows before the productions even starts. They're not getting the kind of experience that creates experience, what we call showrunners, those senior writers who really oversee entire seasons. So you have a whole host of issues having to do with staffing and compensation, and the fact that writers are now really being reduced to gig workers again, and not finding pathways to stable careers. This is precisely, of course, the moment when the industry, especially with the Guild's advocacy, has opened the doors to far more diverse young writers than ever before, who are, of course, the first ones who are getting slammed by the new working conditions that have been imposed primarily originally by the streamers, but now by everybody. The other thing that we're really intent on right now is, again, something that isn't quite there yet, not here yet, but really is. And that, of course, is generative artificial intelligence, AI. We really have spent a long time studying this stuff, but it's, of course, changing every second. And it's changing the landscape, both corporate and political, in which we are sitting across the table from the conglomerates that employ us. But we know that they have big plans for the deployment of generative AI, and most of those plans either don't include us, as well as our friends in the Screen Actors Guild and the Directors Guild and many other guilds, the Animation Guild. But also, even if they do include us, they include us as appendages, as essentially functionaries to systems that they are trying to streamline in order to further extract as much value as they can from as few of us as possible. So it's a big fight. So we're fighting over that, not to stop AI. You can't stop it, but you can certainly stop the conditions under which finance capital deploys AI to make even more precarious the people who are working for it.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I want to say it's an honor to meet you. And I want to say to everyone that you wrote a great piece in May in The Guardian. I would implore everyone to read it just to get a good foundation of what you're talking about, Mr. Seamus. So right off the bat, I've been talking to people about the strike, and they always assume the same thing, that writers make a great deal of money, so why are they striking? Is that even close to being correct?
Some writers do make a great deal of money, and it's interesting because the way in which the guilds operate across a wide array of class formations, right? So unlike, let's say, SEIU or Unite Here, the vast majority of members and workers who are part of those unions and movements are really working within a fairly tight range of salary and career paths, right? These are job descriptions that stay fundamentally working class. The Writers Guild is still weirdly in its majority, fundamentally and wildly working class. Whereas the vast majority of writers in the guild don't make a lot of money. And those that even have good years know that the year following or the year following that could be much worse. It's a very precarious path. So the guild has fought for decades to create systems in which people really could progress up into middle class livelihoods in the way the old industrial unions used to do, the old AFL-CIO affiliated industrial unions, which they still in some places do, for sure. And many of the, as you know, public service unions have those kinds of steps and ladders that people can take. That's all being stripped away, especially by the streamers right now. So you have a situation in which what used to be established through the minimum basic agreement as minimums, guild minimums, which can look very healthy on paper. They can be a few thousand dollars a week, for example, plus health, pension, and welfare contributions on top of that. But then remember that most people are now working 6 to 8 weeks often on series, on shows. And maybe at the end of that, they're off work for 3 or 4 months. Meanwhile, the residuals that they used to get for feature films or for network and cable TV shows are now reduced to small flat payments that come often years after their shows appear on streamers. They have nothing to do with the success and the scope and scale of the success of their shows. They're just like, here's a tip, right? So we're fighting to get that income up higher, so that now even those people at the top of the ladder, the showrunners I mentioned before, most of them now are working at scale because they are working for so long on shows, because they've lost their staff writers who are only working very briefly in what we call mini rooms. You get the idea what that is. Often rooms that are disbanded the minute the scripts are turned in for production. So there's nobody except a showrunner overseeing an entire season, which can often for, let's say, 8 episodes can take as long to make as an old 22 episode season, because things are moving more slowly, canceled, all that kind of stuff. And then they're overseeing the entire post-production and delivery of those films on top. They're not getting paid for any of that. So we're seeing more and more members now working at minimum, the majority, even those, the kind of top end, the boss kind of folks. And you're seeing them working at minimum for fewer and fewer weeks per year. And then you're seeing people, because of that ladder that I spoke about earlier, who are supposed to be moving up the ladder, are either getting shoved off the ladder for cheaper folks coming in, and or simply staying put at their rung for indeterminate periods of time. Where at the same time, those incoming writers who used to come in at the lowest pay scale for their first show, but who almost always, just by custom, if not by mandate and contract, were always lifted up to the next level of staff writer and beyond. Most of those folks are staying at that entry level for years and years, for fewer weeks per year. So we're seeing a lot more of our members living lives of genuine precarity. And as things continue to constrict within the business, you're going to see even more of that, unless we can shore up our most vulnerable members, the position of our most vulnerable members, and make that baseline a reasonable one once again.
Okay. Do you see the studios giving in to the demands of the writers?
Well, we've seen them do it before, so we're ready to see them do it again. The only reason we have residuals, we walked. The only reason we are covered at Netflix and Apple and Amazon is we walked. And of course, it's different times now. It's large pots of institutionalized investment and finance capital have really consolidated their position across all the companies with whom we are speaking across the negotiating table. So you'll often read, for those of you who keep up, about the differences, perhaps, and we don't know because we have no visibility into what's internal to our antagonists across the table at the what's known as the AMPTP, the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, all the studios that you know from Sony, Universal, Paramount, et cetera, but also now the streamers, right? So you've got Netflix, of course, but you also have Amazon and you have Apple. Well, Apple is a $3 trillion value global corporation. We are a small flea on the behind of a very large rear end there. So what used to be a much more intimate negotiating process with people who were really involved in the work together, now, you know, when we're sitting across that table and the person from some large multinational, you know, essentially tech company is negotiating as part of the team across, you know, they're probably 10 reports away from Jeff Bezos or whoever atop. They're not part of the culture here anymore. So we'll see how they are able to work together and figure out a resolution to this. But yeah, we expect them, they're going to have to at some point come back, ask us to come back to the table. They released us. We didn't walk away from the negotiation. They called it themselves and triggered the strike. I don't think that they expected, I think they miscalculated. I don't think they expected the union solidarity across all of the, you know, from the Teamsters to Screen Actors Guild. They did not expect us to be able to start shutting down productions across the country. From Cape Cod, upstate New York. You know, we've got picketers chasing shows from Saugerties on south, and so we've ground most studio production to a halt, which is phenomenal because many of the Teamsters and many of the Craft Guild members at the IATSE are saying enough. We're not crossing this line. And so that solidarity has been phenomenal, as has the presence of, for example, Screen Actors Guild members on the picket lines. They often in LA will outnumber the writers who are picketing. I mean, the numbers are such that it makes sense. There's so many more SAG members than there are Writers Guild members, but they're motivated to get out there and they're motivated to know and to spread the word of their knowledge that our going out on strike is giving the Screen Actors Guild enormous wind in their sails in their current negotiations. They're currently negotiating. In fact, right now, they've extended their negotiations past their contract for a few more days. They'll be for one more week from the time that we're recording this. It'll be interesting to see by mid-July whether or not they come up with a deal, and I hope they, if they do, it's a great deal, or whether if they don't have a deal, they join us officially on the picket lines.
I've been to several of the picket lines as a SAG member, so I've been proud of that. And also as an AEA member, I've been seeing AEA brothers and sisters on the line as well.
Wow.
So it's a great vibe, great energy, and I'm glad we can support you guys.
Yeah, and I just want to say also before you get into the next question, I mean, it's the leadership too, you know, that we've got folks like you on our side and, you know, the history and the understanding of what this does when you have solidarity and you strike, how you can actually have power. Otherwise, you don't. you know? So just had to make that point.
And it's wonderful being on this year's negotiation committee as one of the, as we say, Altacockers, the old guys. There's a couple of us who've been around, you know, over the years. But I would say that what's been truly transformative and just a beautiful experience for me, and I think for some of the geezers, a couple of geezers who join me, is the culture of this committee is so generous. It's hard to describe, but we say things like diverse, but that sounds to me, it's, you know, inclusive, but that's just corporate talk for whatever, for the brochure. But this is really a new cohort, a new generation that listens to each other, that cares about each other in ways that's really remarkable. When I was on this committee a couple decades ago, it was basically a minion, you know, and a lot of guys, there was some blowharding and there was a lot of, talking over and a few, personal vendettas going back to the blacklist even. It was amazing. Wonderful people. I mean, really people you would learn so much from. And they were tremendous colleagues. There are also those who were really embedded within the studio system in ways, you know, that top tier that we talked about that maybe we're not quite as in solidarity with the rest of the membership as you would want. And it was fun. I was great. But this is a whole different game. And it's a much smarter and savvier game than we came with a quarter of a century ago. It reminds me of what it must have been like to be part of that cohort back in the 30s when this show really got started.
Well, the one question I think everybody wants to know, and the word around a campfire is that maybe fall, but how long do you think the writer's strike is going to last?
You know, I wish I actually had a thought, but I think because I've been now both in that room and outside of that room, right, in that negotiating room and since May outside of it, the one thing I know is whatever I think doesn't matter at all. It just doesn't matter. There is no way to tell. It really has to do with the studios. They could call us back into the room and close this deal any minute. I would get on a plane for LA the second the call comes in. They were the ones who decided to move, to play their own little, what they thought of as five-dimensional chess, and I think which has become basically a three-dimensional smack in their own jaws. But by putting the Directors Guild, having us go on strike, triggering that, then trying, then putting the directors after us, who I think got a deal that they are very satisfied with, but has nothing to do, took no wind out of our sails. Our strike is our strike. So I think that they were hoping that once they closed that deal, they would go, look, see, grown-ups, we can do this. And everybody looked at them like, you're crazy. You haven't done anything. You refuse to talk to us even about the most important issues that we put on the table for you. And then they gather sitting with the Screen Actors Guild, which, as you know, as a guild as a whole. And of course, this incorporates its own history of the merger, often, which created some real stresses within the organization with AFTRA, with the union that represented television, primarily television actors. But that they've become more and more unified in the course of this process this year, in the course of our strike and coming out to support it, in the course of their own internal dynamics and negotiations. So we're really hopeful that they'll get someplace great in their discussions. And like I said, if not, basically SAG is already on the line with us. So it's just going to be a bigger party.
Just to preface, so I was a copywriter for a digital marketing agency for about 7 years. So AI, just like it is, as a marketer, it's great.
I have to admit,
scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But my last question is this, and it kind of, we kind of do a loop-de-loop around this, and I just want to ask your opinion on this. I just read that the creator, since you brought it up, of Squid Game, I can't remember his name right now. It's embarrassing. Watch, when we log off, it'll pop in my head. But he said in an interview that he gets no residuals. He had to relinquish all of his rights to the property when he signed that contract for Netflix, and that show brought in $1 billion to Netflix. Do you find that surprising at all, or is that just kind of how it goes?
Well, there are two. The either or is the hard part in your question, which is a good question. It's a great question. Not surprising at all. And that's not the way it goes. That's the way we've decided collectively as a society to let it go. And that's why the Writers Guild is out on strike right now. You know, and what's interesting is, and thank you all for mentioning the piece that I wrote for The Guardian, because I bring this up, as these conglomerates globalize and take over the world, the great thing is it's connecting a lot of us workers across national boundaries in ways that we never have before. So there was an International Day of Solidarity from writers around the world a few weeks ago that was had huge turnout. And our goal in this labor struggle is not simply to raise our own standard of living and get more for us, but to pattern as we do in this industry, not just with the other guilds like the Screen Actors Guild, but now really for other workers around the world. You know, Netflix did announce last week, and that was the context for the story of Squid Game to come back up, that they were like, this is great. We don't care if there's a Writers Guild strike in the States because we're going to have all this great content coming from Korea. We got people who are working in Korea, right? Well, you know, guess what? You know, that game, and remember, Squid Game is a perfect example of exactly, it's a kind of an allegory of what we're talking about because it's hyper-financialization, right? It's how to, but it's completely gamified. Right? Everything's gamified, everything's subject to, you know, the kind of the rules of the game, so to speak. And so I think there's going to be a drafting effect from this strike globally. I know already that's the case in the UK and in places like Germany, where entertainment guilds are not as powerful as they are here, interestingly. But I have a feeling you're going to see significant labor actions being directed against these conglomerates generated in places like Europe and Asia coming soon.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky because it's kind of like the sweatshop labor that we get from China, all the stuff that we buy, you know, and there's people working for nothing. And so it's going to come around through somehow. They're going to have to deal with that, being able to, you know, have these kinds of protections. It's going to have to happen at some point. And plus the movies that are coming out of Korea and China, I mean, they've always put out amazing films, but there's just some amazing stuff coming out right now. But I just want to wrap it up. I want to say thank you so much again. It's been an honor to speak with you, James. And, you know, you're doing such great work. Hope you can come back on again, give us an update, some good news. And yeah, so that's it for us. Thanks again, James and Willis, for being a part of this enlightening conversation. And that's it for this episode of the Woodstock Film Festival Let's Talk Film podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel, hit the like button, and follow us on Instagram and Facebook. And be sure and share this episode because a lot of people need to know about this information. It was just tremendously important, the history and the understanding of how we move forward. Thank you again, guys.
Thanks for having me.